May 27th, Memorial Day. Okay, my friends. Okay, that's a lot of things I want to do. So let me just, I have another computer here. I'm just checking to make sure everything's going. Okay. A couple things. My sons have gone to a yeshiva in Israel called Oraita. Very interesting yeshiva there. Open-minded yeshiva. Three different Rashi yeshiva. One of the Rosh Yeshiva who's spoken for Torah in Motion is Rabbi Blau. So Rabbi Blau published a piece last month, really too strong in my opinion, but a strong attack on the Haredi ethos. You have to understand, I think, that in Israel, with the war, a lot of this from the religious Zionist community, there's a lot of I don't want to say pent-up anger, but just a lot of strong views that are now being expressed. Because at the end of the day, there always was a dispute about the army, but it sort of was like theoretical. And in the religious Zionists, while going to the army was like a positive thing. Just people would go to the army because they want to learn Hebrew. It's an adventure. So you had all this, and the Haredim didn't go. So fine, we don't like that, but whatever. But now the army—it's not a fun thing. Look, you have carbonos every day; people are dying almost, and it's—and with the coming war in the north, I mean, it's a very different thing. And the religious community, the religious Zionists, has suffered even more casualties to their numbers. So there's a lot of strong feelings, anger. The Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva Orot Shaul, whose son was killed early in the war, has a video which you might have seen, speaking very strongly to Rav Yitzchak Yosef. And so I think a lot of this strong feeling perhaps might have to do with this growing divide between the Haredi world and the religious Zionist world. But the Oraita is a special yeshiva because they also have at least one Rebbe, if not more, who was identified in the Haredi world. But his name is Rav Gavriel Singer. And he wrote a response. And it's amazing that the yeshiva allows a Rebbe to publish a response totally refuting or in opposition to attempting to refute the Rosh Yeshiva's position. So you have to give them a lot of credit for that. And it wouldn't ever happen the other way. In the Haredi world, let the other side do it. But so that's of interest, not really of interest to what we're doing. Why do I mention that? If you want to read it, you can read it. It's each side makes very good points. I only mention that because this takes us back to something we discussed in a previous class. He on page 10 of his article, he's trying to show that the Haredi world and the religious Zionists are not as far apart. He says as follows, quote, "My father-in-law lives in Neve Daniel, a Dati-Lumi community in Gush Etzion. He frequents a butcher in my neighborhood. It is a family," and the point of Rabbi Gavriel Singer is to show that there's still connections. But what does he say between the Orthodox religious Zionists and the Haredi? He begins the paragraph by saying that in Ponevezh, to this day, they fly the Israeli flag on Yom Ha'atzmaut, which is a fact. So he says, he frequents a butcher in my neighborhood, Sanhedrin, which is a Haredi area. "It is a family business predating the establishment of the state. It is so old that they do not even have a hechsher on the establishment. Everyone just relies on them due to their reputation." And then he goes on to say that upon a recent visit, my father-in-law, the Hasidish woman who runs it, asked if he's buying all the meat for the chag, Yom Ha'atzmaut. And he says, "You also hold to the chag?" And she said, "We can't deny that everyone makes a barbecue on Yom Ha'atzmaut. But the point I'm making is here, I didn't know this still existed." Here he's testifying in Sanhedrin. You have a Hasidic butcher shop that has been grandfathered in. He says it's from before the state. They still to this day do not have a hashgacha on the butcher shop because no one assumes that they're going to be serving treif. Now, really, in Israel, it's really very hard to serve treif. In America, you can easily get it. In Israel, it's hard to get. What do you get? Going to the Palestinian territories to get treif meat. But the point is, obviously, this is something that no one would believe you if you told them this, but he's testifying to it. And I mentioned Singer, his name. No relation, as far as I know, to, let me share my screen here. I just wanted to say, because I wasn't sure, but I checked it. Remember I mentioned Isaac Bashevis Singer? Let me find it here. Yes, here. I said that Isaac Bashevis Singer's father was a rabbi who wrote a sefer, and I couldn't remember the name of the sefer. Here it is. This is Isaac Bashevis Singer's father. He was a big rav, a kanai, in fact. Isaac Bashevis Singer's mother wore tzitzis, they say. Now, remember who Isaac Bashevis Singer. It's not just him. It's his sister and his brother, Israel Joshua, all secular writers. And they come from a Hasidic family. They had one brother. I think there's only four. They had one brother who was a rav. He never got out. The three secular ones got out, and he was killed. And I don't, the father, I don't remember if he was killed in the war, or if I think, or if he was killed in, went east into Siberia. I don't know if they were killed in the war. I think they went east, stick in Czech, and died under Russian control. But the point is, so here's another example of, the irreligiosity, even though coming from a rabbinic family. But I mentioned that because I couldn't remember the I couldn't remember his name, and I couldn't remember if he wrote a sefer. By the way, on this theme about children of rabbis, just this week I was dealing with the same thing. I don't want to embarrass the rabbis or mention it, but it's interesting. And I was dealing with manuscripts of two rabbis, material I have. One, his name is, he's, I wouldn't call him a Godel Hador, but it's interesting. Where is it? Here. His name is Rabbi Samuel Baskin. He's a rabbi in Brooklyn. I looked him up, and he gave hashgacha to Atlantic Gelatin. He was one of the members of Agudas Rabbanim. Him and Rav Shimon Winograd, this grandson of this Rabbi Shimon Winograd, lived in my town. Now lives in Boca. It's a big rabbinic family from Jerusalem. He came from Jerusalem, this Shimon Winograd. So, okay, so Samuel Baskin and Winograd, Agudas Rabbanim, not Gedolei Yisrael, but well-known rabbis. And you're going to see again, you see often with these rabbis, when the kids don't follow the religious path, they still become distinguished. Who is Samuel Baskin's? Well, he had two sons. In fact, one, Rabbi Kelman probably remembers, is he just died last year, Bernard Benjamin Baskin.
Over a
But I
hundred,
wasn't
yeah.
referring to that one. I didn't even know about this Baskin, who died at 100. I knew about the other Baskin, and when I was looking up today, lo and behold, I discovered he had another son who became a Reform rabbi. But the one I'm talking about is this one, Leonard Baskin. He was an American sculptor. I considered one of the great sculptors. Sculptor is not really such a Jewish profession, but in the biography of him on one of the sites, Leonard Baskin's Orthodox Jewish upbringing and deep knowledge of Jewish texts because he went to yeshiva. But he and the other rabbi who I was, in fact, I published Shaul Lieberman's letter to him, but I have material from him. I have more material. I mentioned him many times. And that's this individual. Where is he? No, I have him here somewhere. Rabbi Leiter of Pittsburgh. What a, he was a gadol, a real gaon in learning, the Leiter family. His brother is Ramosha Leiter, the father of the Leiter, Yechiel Leiter, whose son was killed in Gaza early on. But his son was Saul Leiter, also a big, a photographer, completely secular. He has a brother. Saul Leiter has a brother, lives in Jerusalem, Rabbi Abba Leiter, who kept the tradition. So this is a common thing. And I'm one of our listeners, Ezra, asked me, I showed the video last class of Rabbi Moshe Zivitz of Pittsburgh, and with his sons there. And I said, it's, you see in there the different generations. So he said to me, am I sure that they're not Orthodox? Listen, I hope some of them were religious. As far as I know, none of them were, and I looked and I haven't been able to find any proof that any of them were. But he said that the fact that what, they're not wearing yarmulkes? In those days, a lot of people didn't wear yarmulkes. Okay, all I can say is I think, yes, modern Orthodox Jews from the Upper West Side didn't wear yarmulkes. German Orthodox Jews, I guess, didn't wear yarmulkes, but Lithuanian Torah Jews covered their heads. If they didn't wear a yarmulke, they wore a cap. The children of a Godel BeYisrael in a private video that they're making to be standing there without any head covering at all like that from a Litvisha. We're not talking about German Jews. That to me, I think, is a, I, as far as I know, Litvisha Jews, children of Godel BeYisrael, they're religious, covered their heads. Litvisha Jews covered their heads. They wore these caps when they went outside. They didn't walk outside bareheaded. Okay, if they became super modern, maybe you'll say, but I mean, with the father, the look to me is an example of a changing generation. If not, then it doesn't apply to them. But I haven't heard of any Zivit's descendants. A couple other things. Thank you, Irene. I couldn't remember who the friend of Herzl was, or religious Zionist leader who intermarried, and it's Max Nordau. I couldn't remember. And also, I mentioned you should be aware of this individual. I mentioned him last class. Where is he? Arthur Cohen, almost 100 years old, from Basel, brother of Gabi Cohen. From his The grandfather was a rabbi. You can look him up. People don't know who he is. He's an independent film producer. He's won 6 Academy Awards. Okay? 6 Academy Awards. As far as I know, there is no person alive today who's won that many Academy Awards. 3 in the category of best foreign language films and 3 in best documentary. He's a Shomer Shabbos. In fact, I looked up the list of Academy Awards, and as far as I can tell, Walt Disney has the most Academy Awards, oh, 26, 27, something like that. And then there was someone with 9. And as far as I can tell, Arthur Cohen is third on the all-time list for Academy Awards. You can look it up, though, if I'm wrong about this, if there's someone before him. But 6 Academy Awards. So where I have, yeah, so I have it. I have all the list here. Garden of Finzi Contini, and then three black. I have all of them. You can find them online. He wrote other movies, did other movies as well. So that's Arthur Cohen, very close to Rabbi Yochai Weinberg, that whole Cohen family. If you haven't seen The Garden of Finzi's Contini, it's about Jewish life in the Holocaust, Jewish life in Italy during the Holocaust. And finally, I want to share something else with you. This is the last thing, because I told people, and people didn't believe me, and I looked it up. There's people in my town. I look it up, and I'm right. Now, what am I talking about? I meant to tell you this last week, but it was getting too late. We've heard a lot of Hatikva if we go to events in the last few weeks with Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut. And let me pull up the. We've spoken about Hatikva before. Hold on, where's the. Actually, here. This is going to be relevant in a minute, the old version of Hatikva, the singing. But we spoke in the past about Hatikva is it's Ashkenazic. That is, you're supposed to recite it Ashkenazic. We even say we don't say Hatikva, we say Hatikva. And Kol Od Balevav, not Balevav, Nefesh Yehudi, not Yehudi. We Sefate Mizrach. We don't say Mizrach. And then look at the next paragraph. Okay, so you can see it on your screen. We all know how it's sung. And we don't say Od La'avda Tikvateinu, but actually, the one I'm looking you at, showing you here, is the old version. Now we say HaTikvah Shnot Alpayim. But when I'm listening to the people sing HaTikvah the last few weeks, they sing it like this. And I looked online, and all the recent, everyone does it this way, including official Israeli government things. Od lo avda tikvateinu, HaTikvah b'Shnot Alpayim. So HaTikvah, what's going on here? If everything's supposed to be Ashkenazic, with the pronunciation on this, not the last syllable, but the second to last syllable, or the first syllable, why is there this kilayim, this mishmash? Od lo avda tikvateinu hatikva. But it shouldn't be that. And I remember thinking that, wait a second, that when I was young, I remember very clearly when we were taught hatikva, it was od lo avda tikvateinu hatikva, but not apayim. Not Hatikva, and no one remembers this. But I went to the videotape, and here it is. You don't believe me? Listen to it right now. I'm gonna play you two videos from before the war, and this should bring back memories. Because look, I went to a religious Zionist school. Anytime we had the assembly, we sang Hatikva. I think in one of my classes, like every morning, we did Hatikva, and I wasn't imagining this. I want you to listen. And by the way, you notice they're going to be using in both of these the old version. Hatikva Hanoshana, the old tikva, which we changed now. So here's the first one. The first one's amazing because it's, sorry, here's the first one. It's from Munkacs, that center of anti-Zionism. But they did a whole video about Munkacs before there were 33. It's the video that has the Munk. I've shown you this before, but I haven't shown you this part. It's the Munkacs Rebbe's wedding, his daughter's wedding, in which Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg is under the chuppah. And but it isn't just the video of the wedding, which is amazing. They also have video from Munkacs, other things going on. There's a whole Zionist group, Mizrahi and Munkacs, everything. Listen carefully. Oh, I got to stop sharing and I got to reshare and share the sound. You will hear that exactly what I said. They put the accent as I remember it, and I'm sure many of you remember it. So here we go. We get the sound all the way to the top. Unfortunately, you look at these children, most of them, or in fact, almost all of them, would have been killed in the Holocaust. If they had still remained there, yeah. Okay, I'm not getting sound here. Hold on a second. Okay, I'm going to try to open it again because I'm not getting sound. I was waiting all day to show you this. Okay, yeah. If let's see.
And we're back. The team is looking
Okay,
down the barrel of a
now I'm going to
455
get your
Mangan.
sound. I don't know what it's doing. It's not giving me sound. Let me try this one. Nope, I'm going to have to. I think, something went wrong and we lost. We lost. I wasn't able for some reason to get you the sound, but you heard the sound. You know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna send it to you. I'm gonna put it in the chat so you can all hear it yourself later, and you can hear and you can pull up the old version of it and hear that they put the accent. Od lo avda tikvateinu ha-tikva. Which makes perfect sense, I believe. So let me just put up the other one so everyone on their own, you can copy this now. I had this problem once before that for some reason it didn't get the sound. But okay, I'll just end with this, that a new book came out by Rabbi Avishai David, who is from Toronto or had a connection in Toronto. I forget. He's from Toronto, right?
No,
Yeah.
no. He was Rosh Yeshiva here in Toronto for 9 years before he made
Oh.
Aliyah. He was in St. Louis before and grew up in New York. Went to YU, a close
Yes.
student of the Rav.
Yes, and he
But
published this book,
he read
a
the
short
Shuv at
book.
our wedding.
Oh, okay. The
I
warmth and
grew up
he's
in the
now at
Bronx, New
Parashat.
York.
The warmth and radiance of Gedolei Yisrael. So on page 90 to 91, he tells about when he's in high school. They would sing an MTA, I guess. They would sing. Yeah, they would sing Hatikvah. Is this high school? And he noticed that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik sang it with a different version. So what did Rav Aaron Soloveitchik do? He said he changed the line Am Chafshi Be'artzeinu. What did he change it to? Am Kadosh Be'artzeinu. And he asked him about it, and he said, "God forbid that we should be free, uninhibited, unrestricted. No, we're not free because we have the Torah that binds us." But look, when they say free, they mean even these secular Zionists, they meant free of non-Jewish rule. They didn't mean free of the Torah. So I don't think it's a contradiction. But he sang it, but he sang it with his own version. Okay, here's all my stuff here. Okay, we finished last class with this unbelievably harsh declaration, Laman Das, against the Mussar teachers and the Mussar school. And but of course, even though these were Gedolim who signed it, you notice that there are many Gedolim who didn't sign it. Lots of Gedolim, big figures. Katz himself mentions on page 119 that I guess he knows this for a fact, that that among the rabbis they sent it to Rabbi Meisel of Lodz. They sent the letter to Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk to try to get them to sign onto it. And of course, you know, when there's a letter of not that many people signed it, maybe six or seven signed it, and there's lots of rabbanim. And of the six who signed it, or seven who signed it, I'll tell you how many signed it actually. You don't need to. I can tell you exactly how many signed it. Well, we saw that they signed the original ones who signed it, and then there was a number who originally 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Of those nine, maybe four, what we would say first level gedolim. And then we saw Rav David Karliner and Rabbi Eliel Klatskin signed on. But what about the rest of the gedolim? They didn't sign on to it. In fact, he quotes in here the Rabbi Feivelson. The Rav Shmuel Avigdor Feivelson, one of the big rabbanim of Eastern Europe, he refused to sign it because he said, "I don't sign things that 20 years later I might regret." So we see that it was not everyone signed it, and we're going to have to see their reasons and their response. Furthermore, one of the signers of it claimed, is Rabbi Tzvi Yaakov Oppenheim, one of the like the second level rabbis, I called it. He said that it was never intended to be published. It was only intended to be signed to pass around to rabbis, not to be published so the masses could see it. But okay, I can't say whether that's right or not. But now, if you recall, the first signatory was Zvi Hirsch Rabinowitz, the Rav of Kovno. Slobodka is a suburb of Kovno, and Rav Danishevsky, the Rav of Slobodka, also signed. So this has raised the question, the big debate: what was Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector's attitude? The great Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. He dies in 1896. The letter appears in 1897. The people who read this letter saw themselves as following and signed it, following in the path of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, and his son Rav Tzvi Rabinowitz saw himself as following in the path of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. But it wouldn't be the first time that sons do things in opposition to their fathers, have a completely different hashkafa. In our world, the religious world, could anyone in their wildest imagination think that Rav Shmuel Auerbach of the Peleg, the extremists, the guys who stand in the streets to block the traffic in Israel, that he was following in his father's path, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? I mean, you can go down the list of people who, and that's okay. Children can have a different perspective than their father, but we've seen it again and again. And Ratzir Benotz could say, "Well, I saw more than my father because I was more involved with the local Musar people, so I saw the danger," whatever it is. However, Katz on page 120, he of course wants to push back against this and points out that that there are proofs the opposite. We know that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan had a very good relationship. In fact, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan brought Rabbi Yisrael Salanter in on certain decisions, affecting the tzibur, the klal, and he says we don't know of any opposition from Yitzchak Elchanan to the early movement of the Musar, Rav Yitzchak Blazer, who was the head of the Kollel there. So that's the argument he makes on page 121. He quotes that the Musar people say in their letter that as long as Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was alive, we didn't have to worry about these Musar people because they stayed in their place. But now that he's no longer alive, they've come out of their place. And therefore we have to speak up. But Katz says that many people have the opposite perspective. If Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was actually alive, you never would have had a document like Aman Das because they would not have dared to attack people in the Musar movement the way they did, seeing that Rav Yitzchak Elchanan did not have that perspective, in particular his son. Let's not forget that the anti-Musar yeshiva in Sabaka took the name of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, Knesset Beis Yitzchak. They were showing by taking the name that we are following in the path of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. That's why they took the name. Tell you something else. Claim has actually been made that Rits, Yeshiva Rits Elchanan in New York, is connected to the anti-Musar movement. I don't believe it. It's not. I don't accept it. Neither does Rav Nosson Kamenetsky. But I'll give you the details right now. If you look in Making of a Godel, page 764, Actually, even before I get to that, no, sorry, a little pa few pages after that, because he begins speaking about the relationship between the two yeshivas, Knesset Beis Yitzchak, the anti-Musar yeshiva we spoke about after the split, and Knesset Beis Yisrael, and he points out that basically the yeshivas got along. There was no attempt to poach students. The Alter of Sobotka didn't try to take students from the Beis Yitzchak, and vice versa, didn't try to take students, but they did. He does mention that there was some tension. There were students, for instance, who would want to go hear the shiurim of Rav Baruch Ben Leibovich from they would go from Knesset Yisrael to Knesset Beis Yitzchak, and he reports here on page 767 that they didn't want to let these students in. They said, if you want to hear the shiurim, you should enroll in the yeshiva. And they even tell a story. I don't know if it's one of these mythical stories. That Rav Aaron Cutler, they wouldn't let him in, and he found a way in through one of the windows. It's also stated that they would have separate. They would try not to walk on the same side of the street, the Talmidim, because there was some tension. And look, there should have been. You can see there'd be tension because. Kamenetsky quotes his father, this is on page 768, as saying, giving an example where you can see there's a real difference between two yeshivas, because in Knesset Yisrael, the third aliyah, he says, was set aside for someone excelling in Musar, even if he was not among the greatest lomdim. That never would happen in Knesset Beis Yitzchak. You give it to the greatest lamdan. But in Knesset Yisrael, even if you're not the greatest Talmudic scholar, if you're exceptional in Musar, in the way you expound on Musar, that puts you at the top, and you could also be given given the third aliyah, which for non-Hasidim, for the Hasidic world, the sixth aliyah is the best. But for the Misnagdim, the third aliyah is the best. In fact, it's known that in JTS, Lieberman would always give Heschel the sixth aliyah. And he told people, I had no problem giving it to him because he thinks it's the most important. And as we know, it's not the most important. And if you know the relationship between Lieberman and Heschel, at times there was a lot of tension. So for a Misnagid, for non-Hasid to give you the sixth aliyah, it's not such a great thing. So Kamenetsky on page 499 quotes the theory that appeared in Der Yid, which is a Satmar newspaper, so it's funny that they're writing about this for 1989. The author argues that they changed, they gave the name of Yeshivas Rebbitzin Ochanan precisely because they wanted to show that they were a non-Musar yeshiva. They didn't want Musar in the yeshiva, and it is true there was no Musar in the yeshiva at that time. So Kamenetsky tells us that he asked the author where he got this from, and he said it came from Rav Yaakov Kontrovitz. Yaakov Kontrovitz was the Rav in Trenton, the uncle of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and but then he rejects this, and it really doesn't it doesn't make sense because. Why would you pick that? Well, what's the reason? We know why they picked it, he says. Two of the three people who founded the yeshiva, Rav Moshe Matlin, and who's the other one? And Yehuda David Bernstein, they were Talmidim of Rav Yitzchak Spector. So it makes sense after he died. This Rav Meir Matlin was on the base dinner of Yaakov Yosef. Let me mention, since I mentioned Yaakov Yosef, Yaakov Yosef, he was known as Yaakov Charif. He becomes the Rav in New York. They looked at Zvi Rabinowitz, the Rav of Kovno. He learned in Volozhin. So what's he doing becoming a great follower of Rishos HaLantur? He became a great follower of Rishos HaLantur and a Musarnik from Volozhin. The story is told in Katz's Tnuat HaMusar, page, let's see, I don't. I saw it because I remembered it, and I looked it up, and now I can't. Oh, yeah, page 326. This is the story that's told. Amazing story. Rav Yisrael Salanter always struggled with something, that is, how much to be open to the world with his knowledge. On the one hand, if it was just up to him, he would be quiet. He doesn't, teach his students, but not to be a public figure, because that's not his approach. And It says on my screen my network bandwidth is low, so I hope you can hear me. So he tried to he wanted to shield people from having this, for knowing about his knowledge. On the other hand, how can he influence people? And therefore, he had to publicly, he had to speak, he had to show people he was a Lumden. And this was a constant struggle because sometimes he felt he didn't show enough and they're not going to accept what he says. And other times he thought he showed too much. So, this is the sort of thing that Restore Salanter struggled with. And he tells a story on page 326 in volume one that, once these anti-Musher people came to one of Shiurim and, they asked Akasha, one of the people asked Akasha on Rabbi Restore Salanter's point. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, a difficult shaila, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter agreed that what you're saying is correct. You've refuted my point, and he stopped the shiur. He said, "You're right. I can't go on because it's a problem which you called my attention to." And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is reported to have told his students that, I was thinking about what he said, and I could have come up with some answers to. He says, "Don't think that this was easy for me to just say I give up my shiur." He said, "I was thinking about Kavanat Torah, Hashpah. Yes, I could have come up with answers that people would have accepted the answers, and I would have been able to have an influence. By me rejecting, saying I can't give the shiur anymore, it means that I've lost my chance to speak to them." But he says, after considering back and forth, he says, "Yisrael," his name is Yisrael, "Harei atah lomed musar." That you're teaching, you study Musar, and therefore you can't give an answer if you think it's not real just because it'll make you look good. Or, and it's reported from old students of Yaakov Yosef that he was so impressed with this that Rishol Salanter was willing not just himself, the embarrassment of stopping shiur, but giving up the possibility to have influence, that led him to join together with Rishol Salanter. Now, by the way, Yeshiva Sir Ochanan did not get Musar until Rav Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessin, the famous Mashgiach of. He points out that Rakefet mentioned someone else who taught Musar beforehand, but Kamenetsky says it's not true at all. That this person was a Mashgiach, like in Volozhiner was a Mashgiach. That is just to make sure that the students were doing okay. That's, but not to actually give a shmooze in Musar. So this. This really, and today I guess we can call, instead of Musar, he says, instead of Mashgiach, you can call him Manal, what do they call it? I forgot the other title they give it, the Mashpia, or not the Chassid she was, they give it. But there's another title you can give it, Manal Musari, or I forget the exact title, not Manal Musari, I forget the title they give it, but Manal Ruchani, yeah, that's the title. So that's, you did not have this in REITs. Okay, let us pick up now with the next chapter in Pumus HaMusar. We're up to chapter 9. We've gone through pretty much all the other chapters except for the one dealing with the Maskilim. I don't find, for our purposes, so interesting. Obviously, the Maskilim are going to attack the Musar figures. But chapter 9 is called Hachrafata Pulmus Bein HaRabbanim. That is, the sharpening of the dispute between the rabbis. This is where we're going to get into the rabbis. It would enter even into the personal. And he begins with another sharp letter. I thought that he began with the response. No, we're going to see the response, but he begins with another sharp letter from who? From a figure we know already now, Rav Avraham Borstein, the Rav of Tavrig. Although in 1897 he wasn't Rav of Tavrig, he becomes Rav of Tavrig, and then he goes on Aliyah. And we've already seen his sharp words because, well, first he signed the letter, the famous Laman Das letter. And I told you some about him. I also told you that at the end of his life, he changed his mind and he said that today I won't oppose it because the Tzad Yeshiva students, as it is, are reading newspapers. So what's the problem? But I don't understand this exactly because that was only one aspect. The other aspect was they're creating a cult, so a sect. So I guess his point is that we see it didn't create a sect. He said that in World War I, the Musar yeshivas, they showed how they could remain a yeshiva and, will not be driven asunder. Okay, but And Katz reports that he changed his mind based on conversations. How did Rabbi Katz know about Rav Borstein? Well, we know about this because of this book, Tikashinsky's book, Lamdanut Musar ve'Elitism. Learning Musar and Elitism, Yeshiva Sobotka from Wheat to Eretz Yisrael. And Tikashinsky, in his book on page 211, quotes from an unpublished memoir of Katz. Katz was one of those Sobotka students who went to Eretz Yisrael to escape the draft. Lithuania instituted a draft, and they didn't want to go into the draft. That's why the Sobotka yeshiva moves. And you have a branch in Israel called the Chevron Yeshiva. But he went with some others before the Chevron Yeshiva moved, and they went to, they were in Yafo, where they were learning there. And lo and behold, Rav Borstein was there. He had just moved there before he moved to Jerusalem. But it seems that he didn't know he was going to Merkaz HaRav then. The story was that they wanted a Rosh Yeshiva, a Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Kook wanted one. Rav Kook was too busy. He couldn't be the Rosh Yeshiva. Yes, Rav Chalap was a Rosh Yeshiva. They wanted a typical Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Shimon Shkop wanted the job. We have the letter that Rav Chalap writes to Rav Shimon explaining why you can't get the job, because Rav Kook does not want, he doesn't want the new type of learning. The Rav Shimon's, you know, the Telzer, like the Brisker, he didn't want that. He wanted more traditional learning. So Rav Borstein, who's from pre-Matan Torah, as it were, the old style of learning, well, it's Lomdus, but it's not Brisker or Telz type of Lomdus. He ends up the Rosh Yeshiva. But before he comes there, he's in Tel Aviv, and Katz tells us that he would go to the shiurim, and lots of people would go to the shiurim, and he was teaching Yevamos, and basically, look, he's, everyone knows he was a, he said, begonoso. He was will wonder his gonus. Then what happened was the Chevron Yeshiva comes, Eretz Yisrael, and they tell them, you have to come with us. And he tells us that the Menahalim, the people in charge of the Chevron Yeshiva, including Rabbi Yecheskel Sarna and Rav Avraham Grzinski, later he was in, I mean, he went back to Sobotka, but they were angry at me that I supported, you know, I was a supporter of Rav Borstein. They want, Rav Borstein wanted to be, what does it say here? You know, he had been a Rav, as we know, in Sobotka. They wanted him to become, I think it is, they wanted him to become rabbi in, actually in Yafo. No, sorry, Rosh Yeshiva, at a yeshiva there. And he supported him. So why did they oppose him, me, from supporting Rav Borstein? Ki hayadua, hayadua hamusar. He quotes that Rav Sarna, Rav Grzinski, were very upset with Katz for being one of Rav Borstein's supporters, because don't you remember? 25 years ago, he was one of the strongest opponents of Musar, but that's not the only thing. Why did they oppose Rav Borstein? V'gam hiskim liyeshiva b'tochnit limudim kollelim. Rav Borstein also, by this time, agreed in having a yeshiva with secular studies. And how could you have secular studies? Someone says the video a bit glitchy. As long as the sound is fine, it's fine. I don't know. Well, we could, this could be issues with Zoom. Okay, so Rav Borstein writes a letter. If you thought we saw, what we saw so far was something, wait till you hear this. Listen, well, let me just read it. He published this letter in Hatzafira, another Haskalah paper, but again, the Orthodox published in that as well, beginning on 125. Sorry, not 125, 122. A long letter saying, don't be impressed by these Musar people. They're a bunch of hypocrites. He quotes the Gemara that says about the Purushim, the Pharisees. Not just the New Testament who says it. The Gemara also speaks about, you have to worry about these Pharisees, that they could be hypocrites. He says, keep away from these people, this whole Chevra Musar, which it's, again, the same sort of stuff we've seen. I feel even bad reading the things he says. He calls them, they're Nevo'im, Hatzavuim, Hamikdashim, you know, the scoundrels, the hypocrites, the ones who act like they're so pious and holy. Keep away from them. He says that he says that they're full of lies. They say one thing in their mouth, they do something else. It's all, he says, now they've, He said they used to lie for a good purpose. Now they're lying for a bad purpose. That is, they used to lie to try to ensnare you into the Musar movement. Now they're just lying for the sake of lying, or to get money out of it. I mean, this is like terrible things he's saying. And then he says, we know what happened because we've seen it up close. They built houses of Musar for themselves in Sutsk. We know about Sutsk and in Nevardit. And they get money from everyone else, and their whole purpose is to lessen real Torah study, that is Gemara, for their phony Musar. And they learn Yilmadu, Lashaker, Lachazev, to do all these terrible things they do. And he says, you can't blame the rabbis of Lithuania who don't reject these people because they don't know about them, but we've seen them up close. And then he says, "Hey, this is it." He says, and the rabbis need to acknowledge that they made a mistake, that they don't know what's really going on with the Musar. They have to join our battle against them, and then they can fix matters. And what's one of the things they need to fix? Lagaresh es Baal HaChorim HaYadua. They have to drive out the Baal HaChorim. Baal HaChorim is the master of the holes, the one with the holes, and all of his assistants. And they have to take these Musar houses and turn them into houses where you can create real Torah study. Okay. So, the Baal HaChorim, who's the Baal HaChorim? The Baal HaChorim is Rav Yosef Yoizel Horovitz. Dates are 1848 to 1919. He is known as the Nevardik or the Nevardik Rosh Yeshiva. And the Nevardik movement as we have it today is a direct descendant of it because Rabbi Yaffe, who's the is this Avram Yaffe? The first one's the son-in-law, and then it continues to this day in Queens, Rabbi Faskowitz. If you go to the Pesach program I went to for so many years, he's a great-grandson. His yeshiva in Queens is called Yeshivas Madregas Adam. That's the name of the sefer of the Rav Yosef Yoizel. Now, it's true that Nevardic today is nothing like Nevardic was that we're going to talk about. And, but look, Hasidus today is nothing like Hasidus was. Is there any Hasid? We have a lot of Hasidim who listen to the show. Can any Hasid who listens tell me, is there anywhere in the Hasidic world where there's anything like the ideology that was found in the first generation and two, three generations of the Hasidic movement, which you would find, be it in Rav Nachman or Rav Levi Yitzchak or Radichev or the Besht or the Magid? Do you have it at all? I mean, isn't Satmar all about the Chasam Sofer and this halacha? Where? So obviously movements change. So we have to speak a little bit about the Nevardiker, because much of the attacks on Musar from now continuing focus on the figure of the Nevardiker, because he gives them, he's just. It's too much of a, he gives them the perfect ammunition. If they want to show that there's a problem, look to him. And yet we'll see who defends him. But the Slabodka, it's a much harder stretch. But the Nevardiker, let me tell you a little bit about him. And you'll see why it aroused such controversy. He comes under the influence of Rishon Solander. In fact, from 1870, when he's 21 years, 22 years old, he's part of a Yisrael Salanter's kollel that begins in 1870. And he left his family and devoted himself to Torah and Musar. Now, that itself is, look, you had other people, it's not just Rabbi Akiva. I mean, you had people who would leave their, we had people who had married who would leave their families and go to yeshivas. We're talking 19th century Europe here. Okay, but then he got rejoined. His family came to him. He had children. They lived together in Kovno. Unfortunately, in 1882, his wife dies in childbirth. And I don't know if that did a number on him. Whatever it is, he gave his children up for foster homes. His own children, he gave them away. He couldn't handle that. He couldn't deal with it. I'm not going to criticize him for that. Look, if he couldn't deal with it, he couldn't deal with it. Give him a home where they'll be taken care of. But then he goes into seclusion. He goes into seclusion in Slabodka for almost 2 years. They say a year and 9 months. I mean, we don't have monks and monasteries and hermits I mean, monk, at least you're living together. Unless you're like one of these monasteries in Greece they told us about when we went, we saw them and we went up this big mountain, beautiful view, and they built these monasteries on the side of the mountain. How they did that hundreds of years ago, it's amazing. But in one of them, I think one of these giant monasteries, there's one monk, if I recall, left, or two monks left in the whole big monastery, because not many people are going into that line of work these days. But we don't have this. You would have hermits who lived out in the desert. They'd bring them food, whatever. This is the closest thing we have, I guess, the Nevardiker. He lived in seclusion in the house. You couldn't really speak to him. Pretty much no one speak to him. The story was that he had two holes in the wall where food was passed to him. One hole for meat and one hole for milk. Milk and fleishig. I find it hard to believe that there are actually two holes to pass food in, but Katz assumes that this is real. I mean, Katz grew up in this world, and he said, and he quotes this as the reality that, like, I prefer to think that he was in seclusion and he had a little window and you could speak to him and they passed him the food there. But I mean, the tradition is, and Katz takes it as authentic, that there actually were two holes. It's not like people think that he was in a room and people were outside and he was, no, he had his own house or shack, whatever it was. And there were the two holes, I guess. At least they thought they were. That's why they called them the Baal HaHarim. And you'd think if there weren't these two holes that someone would have said, well, there aren't really the two holes. But that's the story. Now, this behavior of seclusion, having nothing to do with the world and all the other things we're going to see, is totally out of line with Rav Shlomo Salanter's approach. At least all the other students of Rav Shlomo Salanter say it's totally out of line. He no doubt saw himself as developing what Rav Shlomo Salanter was pushing, the ideology, the approach. Maybe he had a different, maybe went further, but he would see this as a direct development. So who supported him? He's living in seclusion here. Well, he had followers, people who looked at him as a saint, just like people support people in monasteries. And one man in particular, his name was Ovadia Lachman. He was a wealthy, never married, a wealthy bachelor. He lived in Berlin. He supported the Sobotka Yeshiva. He supported things in Eretz Yisrael, and he also supported the Nevardiker. And as I mentioned, this, although he had support, he became the focus of an attack by the anti-Musar people. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan even tried to convince him to leave his seclusion, because this is not the Jewish way to be seclusion. According to one version, it was Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelum. There are three great students we know from Yisroel Salanter: Mtali Amsterdam, Yitzchak Blazer, and Simcha Zissel. Simcha Zissel establishes the yeshiva in Kelum, which has secular studies. So that itself is of interest, which I think we'll get back to later. According to one version, he convinced him to leave there when he was in Sabatka. However, there's another version that it was only later that Rav Simcha Zissel convinced him to leave his next seclusion. And we don't know why that he left, what convinced him to leave the seclusion in Sobotka. But he leaves Sobotka and he goes out to the forest. He lives in a little hut outside the city of Nevardik, the town of Nevardik. Now, Nevardik is a real Jewish city. It's always had Gedolei Yisrael as Rabbanim in Nevardik, but he's not living in there. He's living in like a private life with maybe a couple people come to him for guidance, but he's living out there in a hut until around 1895. And this, we're told that we have a good authority that that's when Rav Simcha Zissel, the Alter of Kelum, convinces him that he has a role to play in this world and he shouldn't be living in seclusion. So I find it hard to believe that Rav Simcha Zissel convinced him twice, maybe, but I think the reality is that it's only the second time he convinced him. So he convinced him to return to this world. And the Nevardiker comes out, and you might think he was, he has to, he's not in training or something. He has to get back in the swing of things. No, immediately he comes out. And showing the great talent he had for organization, he starts establishing koheles, not just in Nevardik, but in the cities around Nevardik. Just establishing koheles for people to learn and adopt his Musar approach, and he's successful. And then he decides to establish a real yeshiva in Nevardik. And that's where, we know about Navarre. Now, granted, this is later that this is, well, no, this is okay. This is when we speak about Navarre, most of what we know about it is coming from the early 20th century. So I'll talk a little about this. But he's already established a place. So when Rabbi Borstein refers to him, he's not living in Kovno, it's a buck anymore. He's out there. But when you speak about Navardic and all the characteristics, I'll tell you about some of the characteristics. This really is later. You can only imagine what Borstein would have said if he's writing 10 years later. So what is it about Navardic? Because Navardic, although we see already from 1897, they're attacking the Navardic, or the anti-Musar sentiment 10 years later focuses on the Navardic yeshiva. And if you want to learn about it, what I recommend is a wonderful article from Professor David Fishman. It's all about Rav Yosef Loizl and Navardic. It's called Musar and Modernity, The Case of Navardic, because he argues that much of what, I mean, some things that Navardic did were responses to what was going on in the radical revolutionary air. The pa'ulas, the actions they did, and when they would, they come together, to go over, their, what, how they had been behaving, that sort of thing. These are parallels what the labor people were doing. He begins in the early, Fishman begins his article in the early 20th century, and then he continues till after World War One. Fishman says that, correctly, that Navardic becomes a symbol of Musarism taken to a ludicrous extreme for most people. This is not real. I'm just telling it to you now so you have in your mind what Navardic became, but the things I'm going to mention now were not in Rav Borstein's mind. He didn't know about these things because these things didn't exist. All he knew was that the leader of Navardic had trends that he didn't like. If you've read, and if you haven't read, you're in these courses, I highly encourage you to read it, Chaim Grada's book, The Yeshiva. That's a translation from Yiddish of the title is Tzemach Atlas. And many people note the book Tzemach Atlas, The Yeshiva, because of the figure who's called the Mechaza Avraham. It's the Chazon Ish. So it's the greatest description of the Chazon Ish. And the Haredim, the students of Chazon Ish, they acknowledge that as well, because he was a close student of the Chazon Ish. But he also studied in the Navardic yeshivas. Not Navardic per se, but there was other yeshivas from Navardic. And he has Tzemach Atlas is Navardic. And you see the difference between the two. Later also my quarrel with Hirsch Rasaner, which I think you can get on, there's a video. I think you probably can find it even online. But let me tell you about what Fishman identifies as the two major aspects of the Navardic yeshiva. And let me find the paper here. I don't think we're going out of order now because it's important to let's see if they have it here. I should have it here. If not, I will pull it up because I want to read you word for word what he says. Okay, I'm going. Ah, here it is. I got it. Okay, these are the two important aspects of the Navardic yeshiva. First of all, they relegated the study of Talmud to a position of secondary importance. That's going to be problematic in the yeshivas. You're saying that the most important thing is not Talmud study. What's the most important thing? The most important thing is shleimus hamusar, of making yourself a proper Musar personality. Already we see this, and this is something our Borstein would have known. That was most important for them. The second area is, and by the way, we don't know how great a Lamdin the Rav Yosef Loizl was because he didn't give shiur. There weren't Rosh Yeshiva. There was no Rosh Yeshiva in the yeshiva. They only started introducing shiurim, Fishman tells us, in 1903, 1904, and these were students gave the shiurim. So in these early years, students would prepare and give the shiurim. It's not, there wasn't, who ever heard of a yeshiva without a Rosh Yeshiva? Just someone giving Musar shmuzin. So that's going to be too much. You didn't have that as we know in Slabodka. Slabodka always had a Rosh Yeshiva. And the second area, Fishman tells us, was the student's behavior. Fishman calls it unusual, bizarre, even scandalous. They would have screaming and uncontrolled outbursts of tears and whines and fist pounding. They would try to make themselves objects of mockery and disgust. We know that they would enter a grocery store and they would ask for or a pharmacy and ask for nails. They would push to the front. They would recite tefillos at the top of their lungs, he tells us. They wear filthy clothes on Shabbos. They would say things which are false or just foolish. And this is recorded in a variety of sources from people from Navarre who went to Navarre. Now, you don't find these later on. You don't find this today, but this was part of the yeshiva. They also dressed differently. They had beards, the Navarreker students, unlike in Slabodka and Tells. They wore long black coats, not the dress that we saw. They wore long tzitzis, and they wore it outside, hung to their knees or their ankles. And there was no secular studies, no room for secular studies at all. No books, no newspapers, etc. On the other hand, I have to tell you that Rav Yosef Yoizel, we have descriptions of him. We have from Justice Moshe Silberg, Supreme Court Justice, studied in Navardic, and he wrote a memoir. It's reprinted a number of places, but easily here, Yeshiva Slita, Pirkei Zichronos, memoirs of all the different yeshivas. And he remembers thinking when he comes to the yeshiva, I'll read it to you next week, I guess, that this was going to be some like a monk and some hermit or something. But no, he sees someone who's alive, who's friendly, namely Rav Yosef Yoizel, who's even boisterous. And it was so different than what he expected. In fact, I will tell you that Ritzvi Yehuda Cook, I have it here, testifies as follows. This comes from the Iture Kohanim, the Journal of Yeshivas Ateres Kohanim, Ateres Yerushalayim, number 6266, that he remembers in his youth, that before we went, him and my father, he says, Rav Kook, we used to go to Hitrachetz B'yam HaBalti, the Baltic. They would go to a resort where all the rabbanim were been. And at one of these resorts, they stayed together with Rav Yoizel and also Rav Aaron Valkin. Rav Aaron Valkin, the Rav of Pinsk. Rav Aaron Valkin, he was one of the Gedolei Yisrael. He was killed in the Holocaust. He had a son who was a Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin, and he had another son who was killed in the Holocaust. He had one son who survived, Reshmuel David Valkin. Reshmuel David Valkin, he was Rav of the Polish city Lokach. I don't know if Rabbi Lokach is with us now. I wonder, Rabbi Lokach, if your family comes from the city of Lokach. He was not a yeshiva student. He was a Rav of a city, but he got the Sugihara visas and he went to Shanghai. So that's an interesting story. I'd love to know. His daughter wrote a book. I have to look at the daughter's book. They translated her memoir because, there comes a time when you have to leave your community, I guess. But he, I'll look at that later. So he tells us, Ritzvi Yehuda Cook, that both of them were Baalei Guf, Baalei Basar, meaning that they were both heavy, overweight. And by the way, we know there were we know about Rabbi Valkin. This phrase, Baal Basar, appears in the Gemara in Brachos here. I found it. It says about Rabbi Yochanan. See, Rabbi Yochanan, the Baal Basar Hava. It means he was corpulent. We have a picture. We have a number of pictures of Rav Aaron Valkin. Here's a picture which I like because I found this picture and I published this picture. And I said that when I posted this is, I think, like 2007 on the Svarim blog, I said, I've never seen this picture anywhere. I looked online today and one website has the picture, but I'm sure they got it from me. Because unless someone correct me, if you know this picture other than me, I discovered this picture in an old magazine that I had never seen it before. That's Rav Aaron Valkin. He Ritzvi Yehuda says though that one of the Talmidim from Navardic was angry at me that when I said and it wasn't nice. Lo hayadavol na'im that Yoizel was overweight, and I but he was and but they would wrestle. He saw. As a form of exercise, Rav Aaron Valkin and Rav Yosef Yoizel would wrestle They just do exercise. They wrestled with one another. Boker echad, shnei yudim, gedoli yisro mefrasamim, hitav ku yachad, al pitzorach b'yuti. By the way, I just saw that Reuven Feinzer, Nissan Alpert, now Reuven Feinzer, Nissan Alpert used to play handball as exercise on the Lower East Side. They would do that. So they wrestled. Rav Aaron Volkin, the great Rav Aaron Volkin, would wrestle with the Rav Yosef Yoizel. What we still need to do is I want to speak a little bit more about the Navarra. I realize I'm going ahead a little bit, but I mention it, but it's a development. So we'll talk a little bit more about Navardic, and then we're going to go back and we're going to get the response of the Navardic community. The Navardic community comes to the defense of their yeshiva. And then wait till you hear about who the Navardic community wanted to appoint as Rav. And who's the Rav of Navardic at this time? None other than a man named Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, the great Aruch HaShulchan. So if you thought that Tzvi Rabinowitz and the Rav Itzela and Rav Borstein are Gedolei Yisrael, well, the Aruch HaShulchan is also Gedolei Yisrael, and we're going to see more and more like that. So we will see beginning next class. I thought it was going to be this class. Beginning next class, the response of Gedolei, and not only a defense of Slavutka, a defense of Navardic. Okay, let's take some questions here or comments. Yes, Nissan, you remember Lieberman's cafe in Borough Park, which I gather still exists with no hashgacha. Rabbi Kelman says that Bernard Baskin was a former rabbi in Hamilton for many years, 45 miles west of Toronto. With a lot of these big rabbanim, the children don't mean religious, become big academics or non-Orthodox rabbis. The Litvisha. I don't know so much about the Hasidim, although, with Isaac Besheva Singer, the father, who's a big London, Pinchas Singer, the Rav, he blamed his father-in-law, who was not a chassid, who was a misnaget, but from big yichus, for his children going off the derech. But the fact is, look, these singers were involved in the literary scene in Warsaw. The Yiddish literary scene. All these people in the Yiddish literary scene were from Hasidic background. If not them, their parents. That's who they were. Who do you think made up secular Yiddish culture in Warsaw, in Poland? These were all people from Hasidic homes, homes from rabbanims, not just rabbanim, Rebbesha homes, from the biggest Hasidic families. Hey, like I said, Heschel. I have new stuff from Heschel, which is going to come out in my next blog post. Heschel, you know where Heschel came from, for heaven's sakes? Heschel came from the center of Hasidic, and not to say that he became irreligious, but there are plenty of people like Heschel from rabbinic Rebbesha families who also left. So yeah, Rabbi Yellen says Walt Disney has the most Academy Awards. He has the most Academy Awards from by like two or three times, at least what I could see. I think the second was either 9 or 11. I can't, and I think they said 27 or 26, something like that for Walt Disney. You can look it up. So Dennis Murren has 9, yes, and I believe the third is Arthur Cohen. How many people know that there are, and he's the only living person. He has the most Academy Awards of any living person. That's something I think we should be proud of, I guess. Oh no, sorry, Dennis Murren, I see he's alive as well. Okay, I didn't realize that. Okay, so he's second most. Unless you believe that Jews should not be involved in movies, it's not a good profession for a nice Jewish boy. But Nikki says, when did the Tikkun version change to the new version? I have not been able to nail down the date. It's an excellent question. I have not been able to nail down the date. And not only haven't I been able to nail down the date, I can tell you that in the land of Israel, they changed it. And in Chutz Aretz, they were still doing the old version. In other words, the same period I showed you there, the second video I couldn't show you, listen to it. It's people coming on the ship, coming to the land of Israel. They were still doing this, the version of the old version. Where in Israel, or Eretz Israel, soon to be Israel, they were doing the new version. So I don't know, and
I did it throughout my my elementary school in Ramaz. We always used the old version.
I
So I
assume
don't
that's
know
where
what's changed.
you said like me, right? Ha-tikva.
Exactly.
People don't today, they don't believe me. It's like ha-tikva, but it's a kilayim. It's either Ashkenazic or not. Yeah. Okay, good. So that's interesting. You did it the old version.
Absolutely.
They changed it in Israel to Hatikva Shnot Apayim, and
Right.
then they changed it again to Bat Shnot Apayim, right? There's lots of different versions, and I don't know who changed it and who decided it's it seems to be but thank you for that.
I'm gonna have to listen more closely tomorrow. I at chat they rotate. One day they play O Canada in the morning, and one day they play Hatikva, as Paul very well knows. And I'm pretty sure it's the old version. I don't know from this new
No,
Hatikva.
not to this day. Come on, no. Today, everyone does the new version.
I don't
Shnat
know.
Apayim.
No, the
There
Shnot
has to
HaPayim
be.
they do, but
Yes.
the emphasis on
Oh,
Hatikva that you're
you think
stating.
they say
Yeah, I
Hatikva?
think so. I'm gonna
Okay,
listen
I have not
carefully.
heard that. Everywhere I go, it's Hatikva,
I don't think
Shnat
so,
Apayim.
but I'm going to listen and chat.
Yes,
It's
listen
Monday,
to it.
Wednesday, Friday normally. I think, but Tuesday, Thursday, O Canada. But okay, I'll
It's
get back to
amazing
next
that
week.
Israel had adopted a song. To get then and they I guess you couldn't change it because it doesn't fit in the Sephardic way, but they're all pronouncing it like the Ashkenazim of Poland and Lithuania used to pronounce it. David says, hard to imagine considering the fact that Revel tried hiring Yochum Avovitz or Yehuda Levingberg. Yeah, you mean that anti-Musser. Well, let's not forget, David, that the yeshiva was Yitzchivas Hanan comes a long time before Bernard Revel. Comes into the picture. And Bernard Revel was definitely not opposed to Musser. I mean, but the thing makes no sense anyway, because why would you have make a yeshiva and name it that for anti-Musser? The whole thing doesn't make sense. But okay, that's what the person tried to argue. Okay, there's the link to the article Rabbi Kelman did. MJ Frankel says it's a very nice article on the founding of the something yeshiva in relation of founding of the Varik yeshiva in relation of the Aruch HaShulchan of Yosef Yoizitz by the late murdered Rabbi Eitam Henkin. Yes, indeed there is, and it was originally appeared in the journal Yeshurin. You can see it on his website. Thank you for mentioning that, MJ. That's correct. And someone privately says, or Walken has the tshuva for that bas mitzvah. Is Chukos Hagoyim? He says Yihareg v'al-Yavar. Yeah, I think he says it. I forget exactly. In 1927, he actually says Yihareg v'al-Yavar. I don't remember. I know he says that. He says if you do bat mitzvah, you're a zakei mamre. He was the rabbi shortly of Pilvishuk. That's where Yitzchak Avraham was rav, and then he went to Pinsk. And so yes, he's very much against the bat mitzvah. Yaakov Yellen says, I don't know about the handball story, but I was in Rav Alpert's shiur at MTJ and he mentioned that he played ball. He may have said handball as a youngster. So, you know where I saw that? I cannot remember now. I think it might have been Avishai. Hold on. It might have been in Avishai David's book. He mentions handball, actually. Let me see. That's the last. Yes, there it is. Okay, let me read it to you. And this will end with this. You knew that Rabbi Alpert played handball, okay, yeah. But this is on page. Yeah, it's interesting. He has an article here in Rav Lichtenstein, on Rav Yeruchim Gorelick, on Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Let me read you what he says about. Hold on a second about the handball. Yes. So if you look on page 60 of the book, these are his personal stories of people. He said that. He's speaking about Reb Nissen Alpert, who he was a Talmud of at YU. He said that that Rav David and Reb Nissen Alpert spent countless hours, he says, preparing for the shiur of the Friday morning shiur of Rav Moshe. After the shiur on Friday, they would eat lunch, play handball, stickball, or go swimming. And then they would enter Shabbos Kodesh, daven, eat the Suda, and collapse into a very deep sleep. He said he was astounded by this, especially the sporting elements. So he visited Rav David once and asked him about this, and he began to cry over Rav Nissen's loss even many years later. He told me that what I mentioned, namely the stickball, handball, was every detail was true. And then this is what Rav Avishai David says. There is such a relaxing normalcy about Gadol Yisrael who also know how to relax and unwind. So
I can tell you that
Reb David
yeah. told us, because I was in his shiur too for many years, that he used to go to Yankee Stadium. Well, I don't know if he said Yankee Stadium or Dodgers. He used to go watch baseball games on Sunday. He told us that. So that
I told you that, Reb David?
Reb David, yeah.
Okay. See, there's a problem here, because in the second to last volume of Igros Moshe, Rav Moshe says you can't go. It's a Moshe Leitzin. It's also to go.
That may be, again, that may have been after Rav David did this, because he did it as a youngster. It's actually a long story. We found a roll book where Rav David was a student, and it showed a lot of absences on Sunday. So we asked him, why were you absent on Sunday? And he said Sunday they played baseball games, and he actually said doubleheaders. But I don't know if he went to the doubleheader.
Well, I can tell you that Rabbi Yael, and he might not want me to mention this, but I'll mention it. He was on the basketball team, and he can attest to it. If you go online, there's a great video from Rabbi Moshe Snow. Rabbi Moshe Snow taught at JC when I was a student there. And Rabbi Moshe Snow is an MTJ person, older than Rabbi Yael, and he tells it's his recollections of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And what's great, and what I love about videos like this, I encourage everyone to go, is because you're getting the truth from someone who he was Ramosha's driver. And I mean, just you get a sense. And the word he actually uses is that the Feinsteins were normal. That's a word that everyone likes to use when they talk about Gadol Yisrael. Don't think that they're like these people in secluded, whatever. So he tells a story there about the basketball. You know, they had a basketball team, and there was someone at the yeshiva who said didn't think that this was an appropriate thing for real yeshiva students. That's one thing for the guys over at MTA to play basketball, especially, you know, they were cheerleaders. But they went to Ramosha. Rabbi Snow tells the story that they went to Ramosha, and Ramosha gave the permission. And I remember Rabbi Yael, you told me that you were on the team.
I was, and Rabbi Moshe Snow, then known as Midge, was coach of the basketball team.
Yeah. Well, that's why he tells the story, because he didn't know what to do, because the person said to him that, you know, you're embarrassing the yeshiva, things like that. And,
Etnaflu Hagiborim. I don't know. Do the Rosh Hashiva say they know anything about sports? I don't know. It's a different.
No, when someone says Rav Lipsing played basketball, not only Rav
Lipsing played basketball. No, Rav Lipsing, of course, played basketball, of course.
Yes, but he knew, he could remember, they say, all the lineups from the 1950s baseball teams.
No, everybody knew. Rav
Lipsing. Scheinberg also knew baseball.
Yes.
Look,
I'll tell you a very cute story. Those who want to listen, Rav Scheinberg, right, he was, when the Mets won the World Series in 86, I think he wrote that he feels good in 69 when the Mets won the World Series. He like enjoyed it. But by 1986, he was beyond that. So he was commenting, Baruch Hashem, I get no hana from the Mets winning the World Series. So I actually told this at a shiur I was given here in Toronto. And I said, you know, I'm like Rav Scheinberg. If the Mets would win the World Series, I would get no hana either. Of course, if the Blue Jays would win the World Series, that would be a different story. And whatever, my son was there. He was like 10 at the time, 9, 10. He jumped up and said, if the Blue Jays win the World Series, I'm painting our house blue. And it so happened, somebody was at the shiur who was the ticket manager for a friend of mine who comes to shiur all the time, brought a friend of theirs who was the ticket manager of the Blue Jays, and they were there, and they heard they sent us 4 tickets a game, like box seats as a reward. So I said to my son, next week I'm going to talk about cars, you know. And but anyway, so it's but Rav Aaron knew everything about every batting statistic.
This is something that the Haredim don't understand about the American Gadolim who go to Israel, that they also grew up in America. Look, I'm like Rav Scheinberg 86, but I have no interest. If the Yankees Mets win, I couldn't care less. In fact, I tell people this, not to brag or anything. I don't think it's a big deal, but I think it's funny. You remember of Zev Leff when he was at the soccer game? He went with his son-in-law in England, and they took a picture. He's learning Gemara there. I said, I don't see what the big deal is. I took my kids to the Giants game, the football game. I was bored out of my mind. I also brought a printout of an article. The whole time I'm sitting there, I'm reading it. They could have had a video on me, and it would have been the same thing. That I just was bored as my left was at the soccer. I was bored at the football game. But then we go, you know, you got the Glatt Kosher food and the Mincha Minyan during halftime there. But so I don't know. But okay, Rabbi Kelman.
Anyways, okay with that. I don't know. I can't. What can I say? But the sports, yes, the American refining. Yeah. It's not like that today, as we said. Okay, everybody, hope you're doing well. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman continues his class on Megillat Rut, the regular class. I hope the Americans had had a long weekend and a nice day today. Anyways, and all right, we should hear good news. Like I mentioned at the beginning, our Shavuos Yom Iyun next Sunday, this upcoming Sunday, 9:15 to 1:30. Eight speakers, half an hour each. Should be a very good program. So anyways, look forward to learning with you. Please invite a friend. Everybody be well. We should hear good news from Israel and from around the world. And okay, everybody, Laila Tov.